I do think that things in life happen for a reason. I feel as though I've been uniquely qualified to come here in this moment.
That's Brian O'Hara, Minneapolis's first new police chief since the murder of George Floyd. I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line Podcast.
George Floyd! George Floyd! George Floyd!
Chief O'Hara has been on the ground in Minneapolis for 3 months, the city where George Floyd's murder in 2020 set off global outrage.
Minneapolis Police Department today has a very negative perception, but it's most pronounced here in this city.
It's not his first time in the role of reformer. Brian O'Hara spent most of his career in Newark, New Jersey, in a force known for its persistent police brutality and civil rights violations. After the Justice Department ordered Newark to fix its police, O'Hara was the captain in charge of making it happen.
Thankfully, today, Newark is not the place it was 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 15 years ago.
We discuss Tyre Nichols' fatal beating by officers in Memphis, a case that has renewed concerns that policing remains hopelessly broken in America.
It was terrible. It was horrible. It was an aberration.
Chief O'Hara and I talked about body cameras.
It's important to remember that simply having a body-worn camera is not a panacea.
And traffic stops.
It does make sense to limit some of these very frivolous traffic stops.
And something else he's passionate about solving, gun violence in America.
I think the bottom line is we have to acknowledge that guns are designed to kill people. That's what they're for.
Chief Brian O'Hara, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you, Margaret.
You have had some of the toughest jobs in policing. You spent decades working up the ranks of the Newark, New Jersey Police Department when that force was plagued with problems and challenges. In November, you were sworn in as the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department, the first new police chief after the murder of George Floyd. And you have said, from the moment I knew that this position was available, I knew in my gut that this was the job for me. Tell me why.
Well, I do think that things in life happen for a reason. I think that, you know, although Minneapolis and Newark on the surface are two very different cities, I think two of the most important things that people are concerned about in Minneapolis, particularly those who live in our city, are the amount of gun violence that and serious street crime that people are experiencing here, as well as the issues around police legitimacy and community engagement and those types of things, police community relations. So I do think my experiences in Newark, working around those two issues, have uniquely prepared me to be here in this moment. Newark historically has had very serious problems around gun violence and serious street crime, and at the same time has had historically very poor relations between police and community. But thankfully today, Newark is not the place it was 5 years ago, let alone 10 or 15 years ago. Having been the point person dealing with those types of reforms in Newark, working around a federal consent decree, working to support the integration of community violence intervention strategies, as well as collaboration with all of our state and federal and local partners, I feel as though I've been, you know, uniquely qualified to come here in this moment, because I think those are probably the most important things that everybody is looking for in terms of progress here in Minneapolis.
You just referenced some of the challenges that you faced when you were in Newark. President Obama's Justice Department ordered Newark to fix its police department with a consent decree, and you rose through the ranks. Ultimately, you became the commander of the consent decree police unit. What did you learn from that experience about how to tackle systemic reforms?
Yeah, so that's definitely not a position that I was looking to get. 2016, the city signed the consent decree, began implementing it, and it was really kind of a disaster. I mean, things were not moving for well over a year. So then in 2017, I was appointed to lead the reform effort there. And that's something that, you know, folks in community were very frustrated about, as well as internally in the police department. Nobody saw any of this as being legitimate or even really being possible. And the consent decree there, just like what I anticipate Minneapolis will eventually go through, deals with all of the most significant issues that people complain about as being wrong and problematic in policing in the United States today. Deals with issues around use of force, disparate impact in enforcement practices, internal affairs, civilian oversight, stop, search, and arrest procedures, all those types of things. And having gone into that space, I was the person that had to kind of figure things out. You know, the DOJ and the city signed an agreement, a 77-page document with 225 paragraphs in Newark that becomes the consent decree. But nobody tells you how to actually implement this. This is stuff that the city has to figure out on its own. So having been in that position, I was the person who then went out into community, began holding town hall meetings, listening sessions, where we were trying to figure out how we could have a community voice in reforming the various policies and trainings of the police department. And that was a difficult process for sure in the beginning. There's a lot of times I went to meetings and people were just yelling at me the entire time I was there. And I wasn't even sure what people were angry about half the time. But what I learned in that is when you keep coming back, when you keep showing up, particularly with those people who have been most impacted by policing, they can see through. And they can tell who's genuine, who's authentic, who's serious about trying to make change, and who's not. And a lot of those folks then showed up at my retirement party in Newark this last October and said some great things about me as I was leaving Newark to come here. So I learned it's a very rewarding process when we're able to figure out how to get this right, when we're able to implement processes internally in the police department that we can sort of shift the culture and bring police officers along voluntarily to make a lot of these changes without having to resort to discipline. So that's been my experience in Newark, and that's what I hope to have as the experience here in Minneapolis.
Minneapolis was at one point the epicenter of the defund the police debate. A majority of the city council pledged to dismantle the department in the weeks after George Floyd's death, as you know, and several members later backed off the idea. Voters rejected it resoundingly in 2021. How do you interpret that outcome? Did the fever break?
Well, for sure. I think most reasonable people would acknowledge in a city that has had over 500 people hit by bullets, certain neighborhoods where somebody's going to a trauma center, you know, every few hours, if not once a day. Yeah, it's ridiculous to say abolish the police. I think a lot of times that comes from a very privileged sort of bourgeois liberal, you know, position where people who do feel safe are able to say we can abolish the police. While those who live in neighborhoods, you know, that are afraid, too afraid to have their child walk to the corner to go to the store, don't have that luxury. So while those people who are afraid want good policing and they don't want cops who would violate people's rights, who would violently abuse people, they are entitled to that. And we are here to try and ensure that's the type of policing they get every time. But my experience here has been those are not the people who ever wanted to abolish the police. It's been people who are privileged and feel safe, who are in a position to then say that for other people.
Chief, the buzz phrase community policing has become very popular around policymakers, people who like to talk about police reform. You advocate for community violence prevention programs. You talked about community policing, changing the culture within police departments. You referenced speeding up the disciplinary process for cops accused of misconduct, improving recruitment efforts so departments are more reflective of communities in which they serve. You said, quote, "The work I did around police reform in Newark, helping build and supporting community-based violence prevention, is probably the most meaningful work I've done in my life." Tell me why.
Well, I think it's true that the term community policing has been around for a couple of decades now. If we're talking about community policing, in theory, what we're talking about is police engaging in very specific problem-solving type activities that focus on, you know, various partnerships with community, with a ultimate goal of preventing whatever type of crime we're trying to prevent. What I think has played out in this country since then, since the 90s and all these grants started becoming available around community policing, is a very superficial model of community policing, where cops show up and have a meeting and tell community what their problem is and what the police do about it, and then serve refreshments at the end. And that's not what I'm talking about when I say community engagement. Community engagement is particularly very important here in this city today. In Minneapolis today, we have hundreds of fewer officers than we had before George Floyd was murdered. And at the same time, we have the highest levels of gun violence and serious street crime that this city has seen in a generation. So when you have those two factors combining at the same time, you have a situation where it's very difficult to do anything other than respond to the various emergencies and try and triage as best you can the investigative resources that are needed to address and hold people accountable for the most serious crimes. So it creates a sort of a perfect storm where we have to kind of think outside of the box and do things very intentionally to try and reward officers for engaging meaningfully with community, because this is the time and this is the place that we especially need that type of engagement. You know, this police department, these blue shirts were on my TV in Newark for a long time, and they were on people's TVs around the country and around the world. And the Minneapolis Police Department today has a very negative perception, but it's most pronounced here in this city. And I think it's very important that we do things intentionally to engage, so that particularly young people in this city can see police officers present in their community in non-law enforcement settings. You know, the reality about being a cop is, you know, mom and dad do not call me over to the house to talk about how well the marriage is going. We show up and we get called when things are at their worst. So it's problematic to me that particularly young people see police officers only in those law enforcement type of situations, where they might have to arrest someone, where they might have to stop someone, and those types of things. And that's why I think engagement activities in general, in very meaningful ways, doing non-law enforcement things, are particularly so important in this city today. Law enforcement in general is all about collaboration, right? So we do things very specifically with the U.S. attorney and with our federal and state and local partners to try and hold people accountable who are the most serious offenders, who are causing the most harm in communities. And that's the law enforcement side of it. The prevention side of it, which is true community policing, trying to address the problem of retaliatory violence, trying to address the problem of having too many guns present and having very minor conflicts result in shootings, trying to prevent all those types of things involve partnering with groups who can do things and be in places and be in spaces in the city that police officers are not capable of being, or not capable of being present in a very credible way. So when you engage with community-based violence prevention groups, a lot of times you're engaging with folks who have had run-ins with the law in the past, who may not have had a clean record. But they're folks who are credible in their community, and they're folks who can speak to people and try and prevent things from happening, and try and resolve conflict peacefully, and try and explain to young people why they should not go for a gun when things go wrong. And that's that they share with me and with all of us the common goal of just trying to keep people alive. So I know that's something that brushes up against a lot of what people traditionally think law enforcement should be doing. But I think if the most important goal we have is simply to keep people alive, we need to be partnering with these groups and with law enforcement and everyone that we possibly can to try and be effective.
Since 2020, much of the country has experienced an alarming increase in violent crime. Homicides rose by 30% that year. Many cities continued to see those rates rise into 2021. Initial data suggests homicides and shootings declined in 2022, but robberies were up and most categories of crime remain elevated above pre-pandemic levels. The causes of this spike in crime are still being debated by experts.
Yeah.
What is your view?
Well, it's a very complex issue. I can tell you, to begin with, 2020, dealing with the pandemic, we had a perfect storm of factors come together. As soon as the pandemic initiated in March, the legal sales of firearms skyrocketed and remained very high during the course of the pandemic. And what that means is we simply had more guns in circulation in this country. And we already lived in a country that has more guns than people. And now we're adding, you know, 15 to 20 million more guns into circulation each year. So what we have seen nationally and in particular in cities is a decrease in time from when a firearm is legally purchased to when it is ultimately involved in a crime. And that's just a fact. A lot of the other things that we have seen come together, obviously folks had challenges with employment. Schools were closed. Young people were not supervised. There were not activities. All of those types of things helped drive some sense of lawlessness and some increase in mischief and some increase, in social problems. And we know all of these types of things feed in and drive a lot of the root causes of crime. And we know they're more pronounced in certain communities that are traditionally disadvantaged and challenged more than others. So I think that's something that has very clearly played out, and I think that's something that we're still dealing with today. And it's very clear to me that here in Minneapolis, gun violence in particular skyrocketed, and we have had the highest level of gun violence that we've had in a generation. But I'm thankful because of the collaborations that we have, both with our law enforcement partners and with community, we were able to end this year with, despite having hundreds of fewer police officers, we ended the year recovering the most illegal guns in this city ever and had well over 100 fewer victims of gunshot wounds in this city. And while, you know, there's still an outrageous number of people who are shot in Minneapolis, I still think it's important to note that over 100 fewer families this year were affected by violence. And we are still ahead of where we had been prior to the pandemic. But I think it's important to realize the long-term effects of all these factors coming together in space and time. And it's also important to acknowledge that although it's not a victory lap, we are on the right trajectory. We continue to have fewer shootings. We continue to have fewer instances of violence. And we need to be doing everything we can to sort of rebuild the police department and support our partners as we move forward so that we have good policing that ultimately builds trust in the community and results in fewer victims of crime and violence.
Tell me something. I want to put go to something you said there, because you've thought a lot about the accessibility of guns and the relationship between gun violence and the prevalence of guns on the streets. And you have even said, quote, just legal sales of guns have an effect on the supply of guns available to be used in crimes. So what's the bottom line? Are you saying if there were fewer guns, legal and illegal, we'd have less gun violence, no question?
I think the bottom line is we have to acknowledge that guns are designed to kill people. That's what they're for. And yes, having more guns legally available in circulation has more guns that are available than to be stolen, to be lost, to wind up in straw purchases. All of those types of things do have an effect on the guns that are available to become involved in crimes. And it's been very striking to me, being new in this state, in this city, just the incredible amount of guns that are available in circulation here. And at times it almost feels like, you know, despite, you know, Minneapolis police officers taking an average of three illegal guns a day off the street, sometimes it feels almost like we're just not making a dent in the problem. Because, you know, when people live in a situation where they feel unsafe, where crime is higher than it had been before, I think we will wind up having more people carrying guns, including people who would not normally carry them, simply because they feel afraid. And I think we have to acknowledge that the presence of a firearm, you know, increases the risk of someone being hurt. It increases the risk of a child getting it. It increases the risk of someone committing suicide. It increases the risk of that firearm being used when there is some minor conflict. And that's what we see play out in the city. And that is literally a matter of life and death here.
Let me ask you about some of the progressive policies around bail reforms and diverting resources from police. There are those who have argued, and there is some research to substantiate, that the Manhattan Institute, for example, in New York City, has estimated that rearrests increased by more than 7% in 2020 after bail reforms were implemented.
Yeah.
That was with New York City.
Yep.
Similar patterns have been seen elsewhere. Yeah, there are some people who refute this, but yeah. Do you see that some of these policies have contributed to crime spikes?
Well, I think there's no question in New York City that it has been, right? And bail reform has looked different in New York versus New Jersey versus various other states. I can tell you one thing that I see here now in this city, in this state at this time, is just, you know, there's been also, similar to bail reform, there's also been this push to have juvenile justice reform. And what's particularly troubling for me is when we have young people that come into contact repeatedly with police officers, whether they're riding in a stolen car, running from the police, being involved in a robbery, all these types of things, and being released immediately back into the community with no true monitoring, with no true services, with no real support in the community. What's troubling to me is what I see young people that learn essentially that there's no consequence. And the problem with that is that we have seen young people that then wind up dying after we've had contact with them repeatedly. We have seen a 12-year-old child in this city in November that was shot two different times after he had been arrested several times and arrested in between those two times he was shot by our police officers, by the sheriff's office here in Hennepin County. And the real fear with that is, you know, we have parents who are struggling at times, you know, parents working, single parents working multiple jobs who can't necessarily control their kids 24 hours a day, who then look for help. And it certainly seems like there's definitely a gap. And that while a lot of times people have focused on, you know, simply having reform and releasing people, I think we have to acknowledge that there is an effect on public safety and there's an effect on people's lives, particularly those very lives of those young people who, you know, may not have been shot or may have been alive if they had simply been detained. So I think it's a very complicated problem. I think all these types of reforms have played out somewhat differently across the states. But I think there's definitely some very real gaps here as well as in other jurisdictions around the country.
On January 7th, FedEx employee Tyree Nichols was beaten by five Memphis police officers during a traffic stop. 3 days later, he died in the hospital. Body camera footage and surveillance footage was released less than 3 weeks after the incident occurred. What was your reaction, Chief, when you learned about what happened to Tyree Nichols?
Well, my initial reaction is I'm incredibly thankful for the leadership of Chief C.J. Davis. I think the way that she handled it I think she really rose to the moment. And I think people are safer in my city. And things did not happen here. There wasn't property damage. There wasn't, protests that got out of control because of how well she handled that situation. So I think that's number one. Secondly, you know, a lot of times we hear people talk about reform and things whenever these types of incidents happen. But I think we just have to acknowledge the situation for what it was. It was, you know, it was terrible. It was horrible. It was an aberration. But unfortunately, and we will go through these processes like we always do to sort of look through our policies, our practices, and who we're hiring and how we're training folks. And all of that is important. But I think ultimately the best we can do in terms of police misconduct is to try and figure out ways to ensure that we have processes in place, that we have supervision and accountability in place that prevent these types of things from happening. But I don't think, because we're dealing with human beings, I don't think we'll ever be in a situation where we can end, this type of misconduct completely. Certainly we can all do things and try and have reforms and processes in place in our departments to minimize these possibilities as much as possible. But I don't think it's a situation where we'll ever be in where we can rule it out completely simply because we're always going to be dealing with human beings. We have to be in a situation where we're willing to immediately act as Chief Davis did and arrest and charge and terminate police officers who so egregiously and violate people's basic human rights.
There are observers who make the case that race and the race of the officers, who are all Black, is proof that police violence and abuse from law enforcement has absolutely nothing to do with racial disparities in policing. How do you respond to that commentary?
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I don't think it has anything to do with... I don't think it shows any proof or anything about racial disparities. I think it does show that regardless of a police officer's ethnicity, regardless of a police officer's race, that we all retain certain types of biases and things like that. So I don't think it speaks to anything else about disparities other than simply saying, you know, regardless of our race, regardless of our ethnicity, we're all capable of holding, you know, bias and disparities in policing.
Talk about the role of body cameras in modern policing, Chief, because, you know, there is a huge increase in the number of police departments around the country that are using them now. But their utility seems to still be debated. You know, it didn't stop Tyre Nichols from police violence that ultimately killed him. What does your experience tell you?
My experience has told me, essentially, in police departments, particularly in cities, where we're recording every call for service, where we're recording every stop, every interaction between a citizen and a police officer, what happens is you just have an astronomical amount of video available every day, every month. And so it's important when you implement these programs to have very robust methods in place to audit and check for compliance. My experience when I took over the consent decree implementation in Newark, the body-worn camera program there was a disaster. It was only present in one precinct, and it was a mess because nobody was checking. And so when I began to check, I learned that cops were learning that nobody was checking if they didn't record an incident, and there was no consequence for it. So it was a very, very low level of compliance. So you have to ensure that you have very robust and quick auditing processes in place to ensure that there's basic levels of compliance, that officers are recording the things that they were supposed to record. They're you know, continuously recording throughout the duration of the incident. They're not shutting the recording off early. And that you also have to have critical processes in place whenever there's any type of high-risk situation. And by that, I mean a situation where an officer uses force, a situation where an officer conducts a search, a situation where contraband or evidence is recovered. All of those types of things should have very clear review processes in place. And for search and seizure situations, it's a best practice to have that review actually before a person is even charged, so that we can ensure that these things are being conducted lawfully and appropriately, and that officers then hear back quickly if something happened that was not appropriate. So when cameras are implemented appropriately, and when there are robust accountability processes in place to ensure their implementation is in accordance with policy, what I have found is the vast majority of the time, the cameras actually help police officers way more than they hurt them. The vast majority of the time, when a citizen makes a complaint against a police officer, the camera will quickly show, no, the officer did not say that. Yes or no, that didn't happen. I mean, I think those types of things resolved more often than not in favor of police officers, and then that actually builds support among the police officers for the implementation of the camera program. But the other thing I think that's important, particularly when we have critical incidents like this one and like others that we've seen around the country, it's important to remember that the simply having a body-worn camera is not a panacea. It is not the complete viewpoint. It is a very limited viewpoint from the officer. And so it does not solve and it does not answer every question and every problem that we have. And I think that's something that we saw in the Tyre Nichols incident, where clearly a surveillance camera from above clearly saw and gave a perspective different from what was available from some of the officers' cameras.
Chief, according to data from the Brennan Center, Black Americans make up 13% of the U.S. population, but face 21% of police misconduct, make up 33% of people behind bars, and are over three times more likely to be killed by police officers. You've said that police reform discussions are often too simple and that there are, quote, deep-seated issues in policing that need to be changed. What do you mean by that?
So, I mean, the situation, in Newark, in Minneapolis, that we have is oftentimes police are dealing with the results of very historic and very deep issues in community. And what I mean by that is they're dealing with the results of redlining. They're dealing with the results of concentrated poverty. They're dealing with the results of a lack of investment historically. And all of those types of things, become these visible issues around crime and violence that we see. And police then deal with that, but they're not dealing with the underlying root causes. And so, for example, the vast majority of people shot in this city, the vast majority of people shot in Newark, New Jersey, are African-American men. They're also disproportionately represented in murder and some of the most serious street crime. And so I think that that clearly shows, that victimization shows that there is a clear connection between those sort of underlying issues that sort of, overlay in certain parts of our cities, which is also in the same areas a lot of times where we see police concentrate because of those problems. And I think it's very important to recognize that we do have disparities in enforcement data in policing. And that's something that is a complicated problem. It's not as simple as saying, arrest numbers and summons numbers and stops should all reflect the population exactly. It's something that we need very robust data to look at. We need to look at where arrests are happening geographically, what time of day, who's on the street at those times, and then actually break it down between, which groups of police officers are conducting various enforcement, break it down to individuals. And that's something that should be looked at, regularly by a police department and try and identify, we want to identify for sure if we have a concern with a specific officer, but we want to look at the whole picture overall and see, do we have a problem in one part of our city versus another at one time of day versus another? But yes, I mean, because the linchpin of all of those problems in neighborhoods, the linchpin that holds poverty together, that holds, all of this concentrated disadvantage together, is gun violence and serious street crime. That's the problem that we are the first to deal with, and we try to deal with urgently because we will not be able to have the investments that communities need unless we can stop the bleeding right now. So I think that's a lot of times why police are deployed in certain areas with the best intentions, and sometimes that has something to do with some of the disparities that we see.
It's unclear why Tyre Nichols was pulled over. There were claims he was driving recklessly that have not been proven. In 2016, a 32-year-old Black man, Philando Castile, was fatally shot in front of his girlfriend and 4-year-old daughter during a traffic stop in the greater Minneapolis area. Traffic stops are one of the places where we see deep racial disparities in policing. There are a range of ideas on how to reform them, from prohibiting them for low-level offenses to removing police from the equation to requiring officers to explain the reason for the traffic stop. What do you think is the right way or the best way or a plausible way to reform traffic stops?
Well, I think we should be unanimous in agreement that police officers conducting traffic stops should identify themselves immediately, should explain exactly why a person is being stopped, should answer any reasonable questions posed to them about the stop and what is happening. But yes, I also think it does make sense to limit some of these like very frivolous, traffic stops. It's the only reason you're stopping someone is because they have an air freshener swinging from their rear view mirror. That's probably not a good enough reason to stop somebody. At the same time, particularly in this city, and other cities that are affected by gun violence, we have a lot of shootings that result from people going to cars to retrieve a gun, and a lot of guns that are present in vehicles that are then involved in shootings. So it is a balance. A lot of the folks who are most affected by serious street crime and violence expect us to still conduct those types of stops. Even in communities across the country, a lot of common problems, common complaints that police deal with is folks complaining about people speeding through their neighborhood, driving recklessly, and so on. So those types of complaints from community need to be answered. If there is unsafe driving, that's something that still must remain in law enforcement's toolbox to address, because community expects it. At the same time, I think we need to have certain checks in place, and I think it's very easy to do that, to ensure that, you know, our traffic stops are being conducted lawfully, that there is a legitimate law enforcement purpose to them, that particularly when there is a minor violation, we're not unduly delaying the stop or turning it into some sort of fishing expedition or acting disrespectfully in any way. I think there's ways to conduct traffic stops, lawfully, and that can help build some sense of legitimacy for what police are doing, give people a break, and have someone leave the situation actually feeling better about us than they did beforehand. And at the same time, that still addresses a very real need that community has in terms of both traffic safety and law enforcement.
President Biden has called on Congress to, quote, do something on police reform in his most recent State of the Union address. And federal legislation on police reform has failed at the federal level, you know, since George Floyd's murder. One of the sticking issues is a disagreement over ending qualified immunity. This is the policy that shields law enforcement officers from liability in civil lawsuits. Republicans have been concerned that ending qualified immunity would hurt already challenging police recruitment efforts. And since 2020, Minneapolis has lost, you referenced recruitment challenges. Since 2020, Minneapolis has lost about 300 officers due to resignations, retirements, disability, and you've had difficulty replacing them.
Yes.
From your perspective, would ending qualified immunity make it harder to recruit?
Yeah, absolutely. Make ending qualified immunity, I think, both will not solve the problem people are trying to address, which is police misconduct, and it also will exacerbate the problem of not being able to, you know, attract and retain qualified people who represent community values. I think the reality of the job here today is that everything is under a microscope. Police officers do expect that if they do step outside the line, they will be criminally charged and they will be fired immediately. And I think that's increasingly an expectation around the country. And because so much of what they do is difficult, our police officers they're not attorneys, they're not social workers, they're not, you know, PhDs, but they are constantly called into situations where everything is recorded and they are expected to act perfectly. That's the reality. And they know if they make a mistake that may be perceived as having been reckless or may be perceived as something, a decision in the spur of the moment that was not reasonable, they may face criminal consequences for that decision. And that's very real. And that's right. I mean, that's what the law is in this country, and that's what the standard should be. So at the same time, I don't think we need to, you know, exacerbate this problem that we already have that's happening all over the country, where we cannot attract and retain qualified people who will be good police, who will act in accordance of community values. We can't get them in the first place. We don't need to make it worse by, you know, creating this now civil liability personally for the officers by removing qualified immunity. And we have to acknowledge qualified immunity exists in other professions other than just law enforcement. So I think singling police out, particularly at this time, just does not make sense. It doesn't solve the problem we're trying to address, and it also will not help us get the good police that we need.
There's a Republican Senator, Lindsey Graham from South Carolina, has advocated for a compromise at the federal level on qualified immunity. He opposes civil suits against individual officers, but believes in holding police departments accountable for misconduct of their officers. Is that a reasonable solution to you?
It sounds like the situation that we have today. You know, in Minneapolis, in Newark, and in other cities, people do file lawsuits, particularly when civil rights are violated, when they're victims of police brutality. And yeah, I mean, the vast majority of times, those cases never go to trial. Cities settle and provide a settlement payment to people who have some. You know, a grievance that they're trying to address, that it's something, you know, that has happened at the hands of a police officer. So I'm not familiar with that suggestion, although it does sound very similar to the situation as it exists today in Minneapolis and in Newark and in other cities.
Do you think federal reform would help restore confidence in policing nationally, or does federal reform help you at the municipal level on the front lines in any way?
I think the reform that comes in terms of a federal consent decree, if it is done right, if there are parameters put in place that do not allow mission creep, if there are parameters put in place that actually incentivize and require more than just the police department to actually make change happen, if all of the parties involved have to share some sense of responsibility in accomplishing reforms, then I think that model is something that actually does help. I think in general, having a blanket reform across the country, I don't know how impactful that could be. You know, there are 17,500, you know, police agencies around the country. All 50 states have their own different laws and criminal procedures. So having a blanket reform for everyone, I don't know how effective that could be. But I do think that the process that we have had, where we do have consent decrees that do create reform, if there are guardrails in place so that they do not become just simply a cottage industry where people are making millions of dollars a year, regardless of whether reform actually happens. I think that type of model and having aid and expertise, a technical expertise available from the federal government to police departments, that could be helpful. But no, I don't think blanket reforms in general would actually solve the problem people are looking to get solved.
This program aired for 33 years, was hosted by a sort of conservative television icon, William F. Buckley Jr., and civilian review boards to hold police accountable was a debate on that original program in 1966. That was, again, during another period of racial unrest. And William F. Buckley Jr. argued against the Civilian Review Board. Take a listen to the argument he made in 1966. Here it is.
There is a general feeling that in other towns in America where civilian review boards have been instituted, it has clearly been the result of political pressure, and that nothing very much was accomplished, certainly nothing positively, but almost certainly, at least in some cases, something negative. For instance, Rochester, after the riots there, one city with an outside review board, the police were so careful to avoid accusations of improper conduct that they were virtually paralyzed.
Do you think that argument from nearly 60 years ago that civilian review boards paralyze police officers over fear of accusations of misconduct is still relevant in any way? And have you seen in your experience civilian review boards as effective tools in mitigating police brutality?
Well, I don't think civilian review boards paralyze police. I don't think that. I do think there's been a lot of research done since 1966 that would show a lot of things that people don't normally think are the case. A lot of the police review boards that have been implemented, well, one, many don't have teeth. Those that do and have authority over disciplining police oftentimes would choose, you know, a lower level of discipline than a police chief would. So there's that. And then there's, you know, there's research and professors who have studied various models of what civilian oversight looks like. And I think there's kind of a consensus that perhaps for many of the reasons Mr. Buckley mentioned, you know, the political influence on these boards and so on, that perhaps a more effective form of oversight would be civilian or independent auditing of these types of police functions. And some review boards have that authority. The Civilian Review Board in Newark today has the authority to independently audit and review internal affairs processes in police. And I think that's a very viable option, because that's the type of thing that a federal monitor brings when you have a consent decree, the ability to audit things after the fact and publicly report out on it. So I think that type of, my opinion is that type of review and authority could actually be more effective than simply having a civilian complaint review board that sort of does all of this work itself and administers discipline.
Chief, this is personal to you. You've made your life as a police officer. Your wife is still, as I understand it, a Newark, New Jersey police officer.
She's a lieutenant.
She's also Black and Muslim. And I understand she's finishing her tenure before joining you in Minneapolis. What is the key ingredient for a leader who wants to restore trust between a department and the community?
I think what I learned in Newark is what I'm trying to do here. And I think the key ingredient is that presence is powerful. And that means I have to be present in communities throughout the city as much as possible, so that people see me, that they can get some sense of authenticity from me, but also to be present in the police department. Since I've been here, I make it a habit to ride in a marked squad car around the city. I respond to calls for service and backups when police officers call for help, so that the cops see that I'm not afraid to do the job, that they see that I'm not someone that's going to tell them to do something that I either have not done before or I'm not willing to do myself right now. So I think it's very important to do both of those things at the same time, so that we can build some sense of trust in community, but also so that the police officers see that, you know, especially since I'm an outsider, I'm someone that's not afraid to do the job. So they should have no excuse to not do it either.
Chief Brian O'Hara, thank you for joining me on Firing Line. Thank you for what you're doing.
Thank you for having me, Margaret.